Hi everyone. Bread and Goods is sponsored by Works in Progress, the online magazine. I really enjoy reading Works in Progress, and my favorite piece of theirs has been The Housing Theory of Everything. In the piece, the authors provide astounding evidence for why a huge swath of our social ills are caused by our inability to build more housing. It's a pretty mind-blowing piece if you've never read it. You can find their works online on worksinprogress.co. The link is in the show notes.
Welcome to this episode of the Bread and Goods podcast. I'm speaking to Rohit Krishnan, who writes the Substack Strange Loop Canon. We're going to be talking mostly about the case against existential risks from artificial intelligence. This is part of a series I'm doing. The first one was with Trevor Chow of Stanford. You can listen to that on Spotify as well before you listen to this, just to get a sense of what both sides of the argument are. Hi, Rohit. Glad to have you on.
Hey, it's fun. Let's do it.
So there's the argument that extremely powerful artificial intelligence would be an existential threat to humanity. And you know, the reason for it basically goes that when you ask these models to do something, you are unable to specify your objectives well, and they will seek power. They will do various things you didn't intend for them to do, and that could have some catastrophic consequences. You've written a lot about this, so basically, what do you make of this, and why?
Maybe I'll start sort of maybe a step back, because I think one way to put it is that there's no way to prove a negative, in the sense that you can't prove that there is no existential risk. So maybe we should start like right at the philosophical point, right? Because that's placing the burden of proof somewhere where you can't actually prove it. So my argument, at least as of today, is something much narrower, which is the fact that there is a set of decisions we need to make today in terms of how we incentivize, subsidize, fund, or work on developing the technology we have thus far with respect to sort of the broad umbrella that we call artificial intelligence. In order to do that, there's a set of like technical challenges we need to work on. There's a set of social, political challenges we need to work on. And there's a set of economic considerations that need to be taken into account in terms of who will buy it, why will they buy it, where will they deploy it, et cetera, et cetera. Across the spectrum of these, to me, today, existential risk questions play no part, just because like they are insufficiently specified and empirically, like we don't know what the outcome of any one of these decisions are likely to be. Which is why, like, if you think about the existential risk is important side of the literature, almost a large part of it revolves around A, let's shut it all down until we figure out more, which is kind of a core kind of tenet that comes up. Or B, let's try and put more resources into figuring out how to make it safe, where safe kind of stands in double quotes, stands for a whole list of actions that are the more promising research directions that the people who hold it actually believe in. Might be true, might not be true, but I see no reason a priori that actually stands true. Now, the thing that you said, from all of the stuff that I've looked at, specification gaming feels like perhaps the biggest question that exists in terms of reinforcement learning-based systems or any objective-based systems, that if you optimize for any objective function, you have a specification of that objective, how do you actually solve for it? DeepMind, I think, had probably the best paper on it that came out sort of 2 or 3 years ago. But this is not like a new concept, right? I mean, the idea of like, if you optimize for something, then the AI will basically sort of choose the shortest path, so to speak, to hit that optimization, exists for pretty much any function. I mean, most of mathematics kind of runs roughly in similar ways. Most of code runs roughly in similar ways. If you think about the ways that we have actually tackled it so far, I know RLHF, reinforcement learning with human feedback, gets a lot of flack. But honestly, it's the closest we have got to teaching an LLM something about what our values are and have it not explicitly try to overcome them. In fact, you know, it's quite interesting that over the last few months, the largest chunk of people's feedback for LLMs have flipped. And now it's very much against lobotomizing GPT-4 because it only gives like politically correct answer and it doesn't make fun of Trump, but does make fun of Biden, or vice versa. I forget which side is angry at this point. So we are very much at a point in time where we have some techniques that work today. Now, it's insufficient to place the burden of proof to say like, but this technique can't continue to work forever in the future. Therefore, any sentence that comes afterward, like, I don't really know what to do with, right? Because at this point, the only reason we kind of came up with this idea that like maybe we should actually train it by doing our LHF is you can only do it by actively training or sorry, actively empirically testing, working with AI systems. So the broadest, I guess, point that I would make is that I don't think we can learn much about these systems without actually building it. In a large sense, I don't think there's a huge delta between like safety research versus capability research, like most people are talking about. I don't see that. Like, to me, that would be a little bit like saying there's a large difference between the objectives that people are going for in, I don't know, QA within a software function versus like programming a particular feature in a software function. It's not the right analogy quite because there are no right analogies, but like these are part of the same system because if AI is not doing what we want it to do, then we won't end up using it. It's a little bit of an endogenous answer, right? Like, I mean, if specification gaming continues to be a problem we cannot solve with sufficient certainty in sufficient scale, then guess what? Like, this is a problem that's going to remain like AI in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, where it stays very nicely within laboratory conditions, but nobody actually ends up using it anywhere else. I'm going to pause there because I covered a bunch of stuff, but like, at least that's my broad thesis around sort of where we stand with respect to X-Risk and what I think are, you know, the practical considerations or the questions that we need answer to are not answered at the moment by purely focusing on existing problems and non-existent future solutions.
I mean, so the way most of these concerns are presented is that they typically abstract these agents out, right? And, you know, the question about existing problems, the response would be that, well, we don't consider that. We consider a future more powerful system, which is capable of doing, you know, X, Y, and Z. And I suppose like that would be the first counterpoint, which was that as we go, we, you know, the way I would put it is that if you take a graph of AI capabilities 20 years ago in 2003 and in 2013, 2023, you will see that the amount of things AI systems can do broadly defined has been increasing exponentially, perhaps super exponentially, right? Mm-hmm. And the answer would be that, you know, it is fairly certain that we are going towards a path. We are going towards an outcome where whatever things you say that cannot be that you know is insufficiently specified. We don't know what specific things it'll be doing better than us, but we know generally that it will be better than us at most, if not all things, right? So the question of you know, it's under specified, the answer would be that it's fairly clear that that over time it's going to be much more capable. So it's not what we the problem we're dealing with it isn't that we don't have any answers now. It's just that it's fairly clear that in the future we are going to deal with it, and so we should solve it. We should be looking at it now. And the second problem, and the second thing with reinforcement learning from human feedback, a typical answer, if you've read Ajay Kotra's piece on mm-hmm. X-Risk, it would be that, you know, reinforcement learning from human feedback works to the extent that the model doesn't know that it's being trained on, to the extent that it's not playing a training game where it's trying to guess the answer the human wants, but the underlying system really is still misaligned of sorts.
So I'll take the second one first The second one is an assumption. Like, I don't know. I mean, in the sense that you can, reinforcement learning with human feedback is not a panacea, right? Because there is no way to tell the AI, this is what I value, and therefore only give me those answers. This is the closest we have come to kind of giving it a generic human preference model that is aggregated across a large number of people giving feedback on a large number of different types of outputs. That's what it is. Because like, it's not, you know, Pradyu's model or Rohit's model or Ajay's model. It's like all of us will find areas where we are unhappy with the answers that the model gives, because we're like, that is inconsistent with my preferences. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's inconsistent with preferences of like some platonic ideal of humanity as a whole. So to me, like when people say, no, it is only, I don't know, faking its way towards trying to act like, you know, it's aligned with us, but actually internally something different is going on. I feel like that is a statement that unless you can actually say, you know, that stands at such a high level of aggregation that it can mean almost anything. Because we know what goes on inside the large language model, right? I mean, we know, you know, the different neuron layers. We know how the weights and biases change. We know how actually we know we put whatever ReLU activation function or whatever that we actually put in the, like, we understand how to train these things. It is as much art as it is science. And we, if somebody says like internally something different is happening, that sentence doesn't contain enough information. Like you need to say what you actually think is happening inside the LLM such that the outer behavior is completely aligned and the inner behavior is misaligned. Because to me, that's like a thought experiment. There's no empirical reality here that you can prove beyond the idea that occasionally it misspecifies or it misspeaks or sometimes you can call it lies, etc. The second big problem I have with that is that human language is a problem. We keep saying it as if there is a being in there. It is like, I don't know. I mean, you know, we don't really kind of take the beingness of a particular software system or, you know, math, as Mark Andreessen calls it, as a given. I mean, this is not like the assumption that there is a being in there and it is actively trying to hinder us, harm us, or passively trying to hinder us or harm us, to me is an assumption, like with nothing beyond it, with like, it's only backed up by thought experiments of this is how it might happen. And the reason I don't place a huge amount of thought emphasis on the thought experiment part of it is like, we've had a bunch of these thought experiments around for 20 years and they're predicted like not much. If anything, I don't really know what it has predicted. I looked at some point, I couldn't find anything. Almost any progress we have made in this AI movement has been extraordinarily empirical, right? Like, I mean, we try stuff. I mean, we're talking about GPT-4, which is when people get scared, but GPT-1, 2, 3, 3.5 existed before that. And each step required like an enormous amount of trial and error and effort for it to get to the outcomes that we got to, which is where I link to your first point in terms of capabilities. People like drawing these neat lines of capabilities and say that it's clearly going up. To me, like there is no, you know, generic capability function, or if there is, I don't know what it is. And like, if it, you know, it's a too high a level to be of much use. I mean, you can calculate flops or whatever, but I don't really know what to do with that particular calculation, because there's capabilities in mathematics or capabilities in physics or capabilities in law or capabilities in conversation or capabilities in like playing tic-tac-toe. And all of these have different curves. Like there are some that like, you know, GPT-2 solved, and there are some that GPT-4 has not solved today. And the like the group of things that an LLM can solve today is by no means like a cohesive group that we can easily look at and understand. Because what it is doing is something different to what we are doing. So we are taking the idea that like, oh, I can look at you, you're pretty smart. What if you were 1,000 times smarter and kind of come up with these, you know, logical thought experiments? However, there's a lot of assumptions underlying the thought experiment that there is an it that is similar to you. The group of capabilities that you might have is similar to the capabilities that the LLM might have, et cetera, et cetera. And the last thing I'd say is like, look, we are standing today, like GPT-4 was released, I don't know, a few months ago. We've been playing around with the API. It's fair to say that the hype has both been realized as well as undercut, in the sense that people now know that there's a bunch of incredibly cool stuff that you can build with it, but they also know that it is nowhere close to being, I don't know, some version of a digital human being or like digital god for that matter. So how do we figure out what GPT-5 can do without building it? I have no answer to this. You can't draw a capability line and say, guess what? GPT-5 will definitely solve, I don't know, whatever problem that actually exists within the GPT-4, like, you know, writing out letters back and forth, or like understanding palindromes or whatever it might be. There's every day I see something new saying like, you know, this is a new trick that the 4 is not being able to solve. Can GPT-5 solve it? I don't know. We have to figure out by building it. The chances of like us building GPT-5 and turning out it is as powerful as, I don't know, name your supercomputer, as Ultron, is unlikely, because we know what we're building now, and the chances that all of a sudden it will emerge a consciousness within it, and then it will try and take over and kill us, feels exceptionally far-fetched. And with like, it's a belief, right? I mean, at that point, it's like a quasi-religious belief, which is fine, but then we can't make decisions on the basis of that.
So let me start with the first thing I disagree with. The first part is just that when you look at the AI capability as defined by how well do you score on certain evaluation sets, or how well you predict the next word in a code base, can, you know, easily mathematically be measured, right? And if you look at the GPT-4 technical paper, they have this very, I'm not sure to what extent it's p-hacked, but this very nice, there's this very nice curve showing how easy it was to predict the capabilities of GPT-4 if you do one straight line through all the previous iterations. And you know, I think that's a fairly strong point against that we can't predict what GPT-5 will do, which is, you know, you may not have an exact number, but you'll be able to say that it will achieve this loss rate on this evaluation set, and that will give you a good sense of what its capabilities on real world actions would be.
We can understand that, like, it will. I mean, from memory, like, that was a loss prediction, that model that they said, like, we are now able to.
One was loss prediction, and the other one was code completion.
On the other hand, like, this is also the one where we don't. It's hard to kind of have this conversation because, like, none of us actually know how GPT-4 was trained. I mean, the examples go all the way from, like, you know, a trillion parameter model that was sort of trained just the same way everything else was trained, or like that it was a multimodal model that we actually trained using like images and pictures and whatever else, and all the way through to like it's a model of experts, like it's multiple experts, right? It's 8 different models, what George Hodge was kind of talking about. What that tells me to some extent is the fact that, like, this is very much, we are at the trial and error size. The fact that they thought, like, with increased training, we would actually be able to predict whatever the reduction in loss to an appropriate whatever straight line standard, by it doesn't really tell us a whole lot about where GPT-5 will end up in that same particular curve, unless we already know a whole lot about how GPT-4 itself was trained. And even if we could predict, hey, you know, this is where it's going to end up, it'll have capabilities, I don't know what that means in reality, right? I don't know whether that means that it can all of a sudden write an entire code base equivalent to, I don't know, Zoom from scratch. Or, like, when we talk about capabilities in terms of humans, we talk about what they can actually end up doing in the real world, as opposed to like a mathematical loss model. Because these are sort of two different things. I don't think we have a great way of actually linking one thing to the other. Like, if I told you, like, let's draw a curve from there, a little while later, we get GPT-5. What does that tell us? Will it be able to still solve all of the problems that GPT-4 has? We don't know, because we can't link that particular point to, like, hey, it will all of a sudden solve all of these issues that we identified in 3.5. Some it does, like, now it can write better poems, or it can write, you know, lovely essays, and it can code much better. But unless we have a lot more information about how those training actually happen, I don't know. I'm very suspicious usually of drawing straight lines and sort of saying we understand what's going to happen next, because that's very rarely true of systems where we have detailed information, much less systems where we have no information.
Okay, I think I'm somewhat convinced on the you know, part A, if we were to summarize, would be that we, you know, to the extent to which we have the information to draw the lines from GPT-4 to the next model. I mean, I don't think that's an insurmountable barrier. We have many industries where only regulators get certain information, and you know, the general public doesn't. That's not hard to get. But you know, I guess the first crux would be, to what extent is can we measure? Do these evaluation data sets tell you about actual real world capabilities, right? Now, the other thing I want to talk to you about was, you know, you mentioned the thing about consciousness or whatever. I don't think
yeah.
I think the right analogy would be, to what extent does it have situational awareness during the training phase, which is that it knows that
sure.
You know, I think that is a far stronger argument, which is that when you train this very large text prediction model or whatever multi-model thing is there, it will, and then when you lobotomize it of sorts with the reinforcement learning, and the argument goes that the model understands that it is being trained towards a certain goal. And you know, that means that it is extremely likely. I'm not saying it's possible. I'm just saying that it will have the ability to play a game where its external answers are different from what the internal representations of the model are. And you know, to the extent to which we are able to understand the internal representations, that you know, that's solved. But if we aren't, that means that A, we can't rule it out, and B, if it plays to whatever biases the you know, the evaluators, whether AI or the human, have, and that just means that it becomes a very old classical axis sort of alignment problem, where you're measuring something but you actually want something else.
So the latter part is true. I mean, it will end up being trained to do things according to what its human evaluators are asking it to. But we kind of know, like, I don't understand what the first part of that means in a practical term, right? Like, if you kind of take a transformer model and you actually have a corpus of text that you're actually training it on, and you like tokenize it and you slice into whatever prompt completion pairs or something, and you start feeding it in, like, I don't understand what we are saying is likely to happen, that it gains situational awareness all of a sudden. Like, I don't know what that means. If you take a already trained model and you're fine-tuning it on something, then it's slightly more clear, because it has like the output that it is predicting.
Yeah,
actually,
that's what I mean. As in, you first train it on the training data, and
common
then,
crawl, whatever.
Yeah, and then in the second part, where you're dealing with the where you're doing the reinforcement learning or PPO, whatever, that's when it plays the training game of sorts.
But it does play the training game, right? I mean, that's kind of the whole. Like, how do I put it? So there is a set of RLHF, such as it is today, helps us train it towards not a clear objective function, but a very diffuse objective function, where we say a whole lot of stuff about what we think is good and what we think is not good, and the model infers what our underlying values are. It's a little bit like economists understanding our utility preferences. It's not going to be perfect, but at least it's going to be directionally correct. Is it going to be so directionally incorrect that the model has diametrically opposite outward behavior as well as inner sort of calculations? I genuinely don't see how that is possible. I'd love to see it. Maybe somebody can design a, like, this is one of the things. If you think that is likely possible,
why don't you do a nuclear
we should
test?
Be able to design a GPT-2 that does it and show me, right? Like these are, that's an empirical question. You can say that, like, listen, here's a toy model where we trained it on X output, whereas its inner working was working differently. We can show that in a toy model, but I haven't seen one. Like, and this is my confusion.
Are you familiar with this Astral Cortex? Let me find it. This Astral Cortex 10, where they try to predict, where they try to RLHF a text prediction model into not doing any violence. Let me see if I can find it.
Let me know. Like, if I haven't seen it, I'll take a look. I mean, like we have ways. I mean, people draw hack-ish RLHF models all the time, right? Gandalf, the thing that exists out there, is a fun one to try. People have been trying to get OpenAI, like whatever, ChatGPT, to say curse words for a long time, or like give them instructions on how to build a bomb by like saying, "This is how my grandmother told me stories," or something.
Yeah,
So
that's not an
like
alignment
they
problem.
exist.
I know. Like I'm very skeptical of people who say that is an existential problem, because maybe it is, but like that's not an alignment existential problem. It's just a general misuse problem, and we solve that. We solve that
Yeah.
very easily in different ways. But let me see if you can find it. He writes so much, so I cannot find it.
That's fine. When you find it, you should send it to me.
Yeah, so that's one of those things. The other thing is, so now that's one crux, which is that to what extent is the training game? But I don't think you need to be diametrically opposed. It would just be that, when you have AIs which can do long-term planning, human evaluators would not be sophisticated enough to rate their long-term planning, which is I think the strongest argument I've heard, which is that,
So,
you ask it to give it these plans, you ask 1,000 people to rate it, and their ratings are in high dimension enough which to stop stop the parts where it causes catastrophes.
this is completely fair. However, is it fair for GPT-5 is my question. I don't care about GPT-10. Let me just put it out there, because like I don't know what it is going to be like. Nobody does. So making assumptions about super intelligence before you actually figure out what it is likely to do is going to end up in a certain like a loop, right? I mean, then you're it's like solving it's like you're assuming the answer to the problem. Because like when we are training the next system, what should we be worried about in terms of existential risk is my first question. Like the next system that we are training, once it like if any of these things that get demonstrated, can we understand it well enough and stop it? Yeah, right. Six systems down the line, I don't know, right? You don't know, I don't know. We don't know what the structure is likely to be to kind of get there. But my understanding of pretty much everything that humans do generally kind of stands to reason that, like, hey, if you're going to create a system, the only way it's going to get deployed is if it actually solves genuine real life problems. I mean, we still. So I used to be on the board of this company that did deep learning based cybersecurity. We had the devil of a time trying to actually deploy it into large sort of banks or insurance companies, et cetera. And the reason wasn't that it didn't work because it blew every benchmark, but because like people had a fundamental disbelief of like, oh, but how does it do what it does? And there's no easy way to kind of explain it and answer it without explaining what deep learning was, which was a pain in the ass. This problem exists throughout the world, right? Like, when Google gives me a bad search result, I don't care because like the cost is very low. When Renaissance Technologies has an AI model that spits out a bad trade, it doesn't care because it can kind of cover its loss and move on, and then it kind of works out. When a cancer diagnosis comes with a bad result, it really matters. So that's why in certain sets of domains, we always are going to have much higher levels of oversight. And you can't paint these with a broad brush at all, right? So, using LLMs to write your school homework, I mean, it's fine. You've got to be sensible enough to kind of take out as an AI language model phrase. And if you're not, you're going to get caught. You probably should not rely on LLMs to kind of write your court transcripts or like citations, because it kind of hallucinates and makes up stuff, as we have seen in sort of the recent case. So to me, like, how you use the technology is important. You can't kind of paint with a broad brush and say, like the people who say it hallucinates and it's useless are also idiots, right? Versus people who say it's so capable that it's gonna like destroy the world. Because like from GPT-4, where it has prompt injection problems, it has hallucination problems, all the way through to super intelligence, there is no straight line. There's a whole list of considerations where we, all of us, have to understand it. Maybe not even understand it, like it, trust it enough that we are willing to deploy it into systems where we think it will produce value. And across our entire society, there are checks and balances up the wazoo, from like individual use to group use to company use to governmental use to like this doesn't stop. So while theoretically, yeah, I mean, a sufficiently powerful system might be able to come up with like loopholes that fall through the 1,000 human reviewers' preferences, that, you know, it threads that needle in order to find that pathway in order to destroy everybody. Like, that's not where we are. So I'm not entirely sure why we should care about like a hypothetical scenario when
that's
there's a scenario
just a question
that
of, that's just a question of long timelines, right? As in, you know,
it's not. Let me just complete. So like, I think people kind of assume that like nothing happens by happenstance, right? I mean, people have to design and build these things in order for us to get there. It doesn't just happen automatically. There's no like, hey, there's a long, in a long enough timeline, things will get deployed everywhere. Yeah, but like what it gets deployed like is not like what you're expecting today. When the first electric transformer was created, and somebody must have said like, oh, in a long enough timeline, it'll get deployed everywhere, and therefore it will have ABC problems. In fact, there were cartoons about it. They were also wrong, because it did get deployed everywhere, but the modern electric grid has not that much in common with what the people were assuming then, because they made it systematic, they made it reliable, there's redundancies, it actually works. There's a whole, I don't know, assuming away all of the practical problems kind of makes you misunderstand what the technology actually is like. I mean, the Model T, the first car that Ford made, has like, how much does it have in common with, like, I don't know, my car, right? Like, not, I mean, yeah, the shape is similar, it has four wheels, but like the internal stuff is entirely different, because it has evolved over like 80 years, where every single time something happened, we fixed it, we made it better. Not just like airbags and like better brakes and automatic gearbox, but like a whole host of other things, each one of which was an iterative improvement over the thing that came before. Like, you can't just assume away that entire progress.
So the first part would be that, okay, now I take it that you're generally suspicious of the abstraction level of thinking, I spoke with Rakesh a while ago, and like,
yeah,
we had the same argument, which is that you know, I'd argue that people who worry about X disk are abstraction level thinkers, while people who are less convinced of it as object level thinker. So I guess the main the main difference in thinking style would be that if you believe in the abstraction thing, it would make little sense to think about deployment levels, because that can be just abstracted away. And to an extent, I think it can,
yeah,
given the speed at which we've had both correct and incorrect deployment of AI technology. I mean, anybody who's used ChatGPT for more than maybe 15-20 minutes knows that it has the ability to hallucinate. And yet you had a lawyer use it. And, you know, so I guess I'm not sure to what extent it's right or wrong, but I agree.
But that's good, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a self-correcting system.
No, you're correct in saying that for this minor use, it's a self-correcting system. But if you believe that the flaws of AI systems will be less visible in the future, then you...
Hold on. Let's not jump to the future. I think this is the problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Once you say, like, the flaws will be less visible in the future,
mm-hmm.
you're skipping from today, where the flaws are visible, mm-hmm. assuming we fix the visible flaws and nothing else changes when we go to the future. I don't know. Like, to me, that is a huge gap to jump through. Like, when I say that we don't know exactly how we will be able to deal with GPT-5, like, in that assumption, when people kind of say things like, in the future, the flaws will be less visible, what they're assuming is a system exactly like GPT-4, except larger, and like, it also has flaws, but we can't see them. That you get how that is like assuming the endpoint, right?
No, yeah,
you're effectively assuming a system that cannot be tested. That's
yeah.
my problem. Like, you can't just assume a system that can't be analyzed or tested and assume that it will get widely deployed, and then say that like wide deployment of untested systems with loopholes are going to cause problems, because that's a circular argument. Your assumptions fundamentally explain to you what's likely to happen.
Let me rephrase it. They're arguing by analogy, which is that you have certain... I don't consider arguing by analogy to be wrong. As in, so let me restate what you said to ensure I understood, which is that, you know, what you're saying is that GPT-5 won't be the same as GPT-4, and we will act, and you know, we can't really say that the problems of GPT-5 will be the problems of GPT-4 just multiplied by n, because we will be you know, because we will test it, change it, and so on. Is that correct?
Yes, I have two points. Point number one is that assuming future capabilities before saying those capabilities are insufficient is a circular problem. And number two is the fact that if there are problems with the current systems, they do not get deployed. And if they do not get deployed, then the fundamental final problem doesn't exist. Like, that's my point, right? Like, there is no leap from GPT-4 to GPT-10 where things don't get deployed at a wide scale, right? Like, I mean, it doesn't exist. Like, if nothing actually gets ever deployed, like the assumption of like it'll become like a lab leak where GPT-8 just escapes the labs and takes over the world, these are science fiction stories. Like, you have to assume so many things before that becomes true that at that point, I'm very happy to believe it. I'll read a book about it, but like, that doesn't tell you anything about what you should do today or what you should plan for tomorrow. To me, like, the most important questions are, from all of the stuff that we have said, there's a few concrete things, right? Like, prompt injection is a super important problem that we need to solve. Hallucination is a super important problem that we need to solve. Both of these are necessary for it to get widespread deployment and for us to trust its outputs. Specification gaming is a problem that we don't know how far it is likely to go. Also an important problem for us to kind of deploy it. I don't know whether we will solve these problems like once and forever, like, you know, Pythagoras theorem, we kind of create the theorem and it stands true for the rest of time. It's more likely going to be like one of those numerical methods that work until a certain set of points and after which it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Once we have some solutions that work for today, then today's technology will get deployed in a few different places. We will create tomorrow's technology, which will inevitably show up with new problems. It is impossible that GPT-5 just shows up and has no problems. Like, I see no world where that is likely. And if GPT-5 shows up with new problems, we're going to have to solve those problems before we get to GPT-6. At which point, like, you're looking at GPT-6 and saying, oh man, it can, you know, defeat any human at chess and it is so impossibly good at mathematics. But specification gaming is a problem. Kind of doesn't tell you much, because specification gaming as an issue at that point versus what it does today are two different things. There is a difference in scale. Sufficient difference in scale creates a difference in scope. So you can't extrapolate today's problems to tomorrow's technology by saying like capabilities improve, but nothing else changes, because that's not how anything works. That's like saying, I don't know, if you drove Model T at 60 miles an hour, then all the cars in the highway are going to catch fire, which assumes the existence of like, that's not how cars got widespread, right? Or like the original Transformers, if you were to set electricity through and had grids that created multiple terawatts, then like everything, the whole grid will catch fire. That's not how, like, this is not how technology actually kind of spreads. You have to create stuff for safety as you see it and slowly kind of iteratively deploy it over a period of time.
I agree with most of that. Okay. So I agree with some, maybe a majority, a few minor points here and there. But what do you make of the argument that competitive pressures will mean that we will do less testing than required for these? Because part of your argument is just that we will build GPT, you know, whatever future versions, maybe not large language models even, but whatever future versions we build, we will test it, we will figure these problems out. And but companies which are in a competitive rush, and we've seen that quite a bit, inflection raised, I think, over $1 billion recently. Google, you know, every single big tech company wants a GPT model trained by themselves now. So it's not implausible to say that, you know, in the competitive race, people will deploy it to semi-critical or even critical applications. And if this becomes part of nation states' strategy, we've seen multiple examples in the Cold War when, you know, governments did really, really stupid things with technologies that nobody would consider sane, but they did it because the other guy was going to do it first. What do you make of that argument?
So I find it fairly difficult to grasp for two reasons. One is the empirical reason that if you go into any mission critical technology that exists around the world, whether it's like missile defense system or, you know, governmental security systems or banks backends, these are run on tried and tested technologies that nobody fucks with, right? Like, this is not something that actually gets messed around whenever anything new comes. I mean, if you think about how long it took before banks would even consider deploying a cloud instance on their sort of, like, this is not a, oh yeah, yeah, because of competitive pressures we have to do. And arguably for a lot of companies, there was enormous competitive pressure for them to kind of do any of these tech things over the last 20 years, because they would have raised, they would have got an enormous sort of bump in their ROE, right? For example, they don't do it because the downside risk is very high. There is no future I see where that downside risk just gets ignored, because that's not how competitive pressures actually work in the real world. Like, competitive pressure is not like a, I don't know, a magical sort of system, right? Like, it does not matter how much money like Inflection, Google, blah, blah, blah raises in order to kind of deploy into this, because like the amount of money that they deploy is still minuscule compared to the OPEX for most of these large companies. I think like JP Morgan, Fidelity spend billions in their, just their IT budget annually, OPEX. Like, that comprises the total investment into every LLM that we have seen so far historically. So like, this is, these are very large numbers, and there's a large set of fairly jaded, old, dare I say, like conservative counterparties that you need to convince that this technology A, does what you say it does, and B, like, you are going to be able to use it to create better value for yourself and your customers. To me, that's a fairly powerful push. Now, is this pressure sufficient for them to do, go above and beyond in order to do weird sort of, you know, cyber, like weird security hacks? No, because if there's one thing we've seen from all of the cybersecurity hacks that have happened in the past, it is that like at a certain, for most companies, they think of a certain number of hacks and personal data loss as like cost of doing business. Because they're like, everybody's getting it. If we get hacked, we have no reputational problem because everybody's gotten hacked. So like, there'll be some fines and we'll have to pay some money and it's fine, right? I mean, they know the cost of doing business. If it becomes like that, then yeah, there's going to be a bit more of a widespread deployment. But like the step from today where we are, in order to get to the point where these systems actually exist everywhere, you actually interact with software, is a very long way away. This isn't, I don't know about timelines, but at least capability wise, we need to jump a fair bit before it actually gets deployed everywhere. It's not easy. I mean, just to put it in perspective, cloud, which has been being talked about by like the next big thing for, I don't know, 12 years since Salesforce pretty much, or at least like 12 years. It only recently passed like on-premise deployments in terms of sort of, you know, total market share. In fact, for many companies, at least a few that I know, have moved backwards because they said like, oh, it is too expensive or the latency is high. And therefore, we would rather kind of go back into control because now we can do that more cheaply as well. These things go in shifts. It is very hard to assume away deployment problems because, like, I don't know, real world is sticky.
Okay, I somewhat agree with that. But AI technology are deployed way faster than any other technology, right? It took just from a consumer
they're
point
not.
Of view.
No, they're not. They're deployed to us right. In low risk situations.
Okay,
they're not deployed in anything higher risk,
highest
right? Like
situations, you're never going to have a JP Morgan having an LLM code base in the next foreseeable future.
I don't know. Maybe they will, but like, it's not going to be in like, they're not going to start off doing it with your consumer banking app in order to invest your money, right? They will do it somewhere in a prop trading floor where they don't care if they lose a bit of capital. They'll test it out with their chatbot. There is a sequence of deployment where they're not going to start with like open heart surgery. They're first going to try doing it in different places. And if it works, then they will move it elsewhere. And all we're talking about is the amount of testing that is required before it sort of gets deployed everywhere, if that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is the delta that is important here. Because if it, let's assume a world where it actually does get deployed in like 50% of the things that we interact with on a daily basis or like a major systems, mm-hmm. At which point, can you imagine if it is deployed in that many places and we are not seeing like crazy problems, then I would assume that like we should have a higher confidence that some of the problems has been solved empirically, if not theoretically, which is kind of all we can do, right? I mean, when cloud was being deployed, I remember having conversations saying like, it's going to create a single source of failure because like there's only one thing you need to hack versus sort of whatever your bare metal. And over sort of, it took a few years of convincing to say like, this actually is a better and more secure solution for most of you guys. It somewhat worked for at least a chunk of people. A chunk still don't believe it. Maybe they'll believe it sort of eventually, but like, these are not sort of simple. You don't start with the hardest problem and deploy, right? I doubt we're going to start seeing LLMs doing open heart surgery or like, you know, anytime soon. We're going to first start seeing it in like we said, chatbots, because chatbots are the quintessential example of like, it can't hurt you unless you use it to hurt yourself, at which point, like, you know, Darwin's law applies. But what's the problem? Like, I mean, if companies deploy, they'll do it in like talking to your code base or talking to your like FAQ system. These are all small things, right? We haven't seen sort of the core basis of a company actually shift and being run by an LLM. There's a whole list of reasons why, but like, they're just not there yet.
I actually think the main crux would be that they is that deployment would not be a problem, because if you read any of the it's quite unfortunate it's all in blog posts, but if you read any of the blog posts, it would be that, you know, you start asking it to do a simple task like paper clips, or in the more sophisticated versions, it would be scientific research. And scientific research, it, you know, it optimizes scientific research well, but it buys up. And, you know, we haven't talked about instrumental convergence a bit. So let's shift to that. And the argument would be that you ask it to make new paper, do the paperclip thing, and builds this huge paperclip factory. And it, murders the journalist asking why it's building so many paperclips and so on and on and on and on. But this happens extremely fast. And this seems plausible, but I personally find it quite unlikely as a failure mode analogy. What do you think of it?
So I'll be honest, I never fully understood what that was supposed to be like. I still don't fully understand what instrumental convergence specifically means.
It just means you get more power to do the things your users ask you to.
Yeah, but I'm like, every example I hear of it sounds like a stupid person's idea of a smart person, or, you know, something equivalent. It's like, it is smart enough to understand everything about how to turn the entire world into paperclips, but it does not understand that the question it is being asked of like creating more paperclips has a natural endpoint. That feels like a willful misunderstanding or just a really dumb bot. Mm-hmm. And if anything, even with like the baby AGI stuff that Yohei created recently,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't. It already does not do that. It stops. You ask it to do something, it stops somewhere in the middle, or creates a list of like six steps and like six sub-steps that stops at that point.
No,
I mean, I agree, are you
that,
saying
but
we're going to go backwards? I find it a bizarre argument.
Yeah, no, I suppose that is the shortest, clearest answer I've got. I somewhat agree with that, but the problem would be when it's in charge of. Larger systems, which I guess ties back to your point about deployment. I buy that if you make a bot to some of the plugins or OpenAI is doing or something that orders groceries for you, right? But the one of the more core beliefs is that in the near future, next 20, 30 years, we'll be delegating a lot of power and hard resources, which makes this, you know, this a very unlikely thing, slightly more likely, because if you start doing long-term planning, which is, you know, instead of make these paperclips for me, your thing is you're the shareholder of this paperclip organization. And that makes that, the possibility of you gaining more power so you can use it in the future, that seems a lot more likely.
But I guess that your answer would be that we can't really jump to that conclusion because in the end we have to cross the river by feeling the stones. So you can't really assume what what this thing is going to do. Is that
Yeah, I
am
feel
I?
like a lot of the people kind of making these arguments have never actually tried to deploy a large system into a complex like organization. Because it's like, I feel, guys, I mean, just try it once. I promise you will learn a lot. But let me flip it around. Let me give you a scenario which I think actually is plausible in terms of how we might get something that actually goes wrong, right? Like, because I feel it's only fair. So, roll the clock forward sort of several years, whatever. We have found some of the core problems today. We have somewhat solved them. We've solved hallucination for the most part. Output consistency is we kind of already have it, but gotten better. It can create decentish plans and kind of execute them by like using the tools that you've kind of given it. Prompt injection is less of a problem. So like it's good enough. We can kind of solve it in places. It's deployed in a few different sort of parts of the world. There is still the issue that effectively we have increased the complexity of the overall system, where there's a large number of either autonomous agents or semi-autonomous agents or just generic AI models that are running that will interact with each other in like unforeseeable ways. I think this is a fact. This is not a like there is no way that we will be able to foresee how they will actually interact with each other. So I see sort of no way around it. At which point, I feel somewhere in the future, is it possible that like we are going to see something equivalent to like the algorithmic flash crash that happened in the financial markets? Possible. That is a risk that genuinely exists because we are sufficiently increasing the complexity of the systems that we cannot predict like how each interaction of the system with each other will happen. Maybe we'll be able to build in enough circuit breakers, maybe not. I don't know how that will work, but like I can see that actually being a problem coming in the future. I don't think it's an existential risk still, but I see that as a problem, right? Like it can cause, I don't know, large scale economic casualties, possibly, but I doubt it's going to result in huge amount of human casualties unless, the US Army decides to kind of integrate LLMs into their kill bots, which is at which point I would say the delta in kill casualty, I'd be interested to know whether it goes up or high, down, but like that's a different question. But this is a problem that I genuinely think exists. I am relatively confident we will see in our lifetimes, if not in sort of the next 10 years. And there's no way to kind of sidestep it or prove that it will not happen. There, I've become a doomer.
Let me try and summarize everything you've said so I have a good I have a good understanding of what it is. The first part is just that you can't deal with these abstractions. You can't say GPT-10 will do this because we have no idea what it will be, and the path of these models evolving would be is it changes so much that that you can't reliably draw any conclusions from it, right? That's the first point. The second thing I the second thing I would remember is I would say is that deployment is much harder. It's much later, and you can't really you can't just assume it away. And then regarding instrumental convergence, it would be that I do agree that the simple example of a paperclip maximizer just has a lot of technological development in making paper clips, but not in understanding the intention of the person giving it to you. And then, I think you agree with the fact that if we have large scale planning, we might have these catastrophic or many catastrophic incidents where where the plans don't work well, but probably won't be worse than any of the human catastrophes we have already. It might be. Is there anything I'm missing from what you've said so far?
No, I think I broadly agree with all of that. I mean, I'm not even saying it won't be worse than human catastrophes. Maybe it will be worse. I have no idea. But I sort of don't foresee a future where, because of the fear of those catastrophes, we should stop doing what we're doing. That's kind of the broader issue, right? I mean, there is, just for completeness, there is a future where once we create, I don't know, GPT-5, GPT-6 or something, where we understand enough about how the LLM system evolves that we are like, God damn it. We're reasonably confident that if we create GPT-6, it's not going to be particularly beneficial or useful. And we have to shift a little bit to like a biotech model or something where we are like, we don't know if this thing actually works. It's starting to show signs of X for any value of X, you know, sentience, conscience, like it is kind of inner alignment is clearly kind of going awry into outer alignment point where we have to get there. I mean, is that possible? Yeah, I don't see why not. I don't think we can predict it today. And most importantly, nothing we see today kind of should make us imagine that this is the case. Even if you read statements that people who have built it say, like Jeff Hinton or like Yoshio Benigo, they all hand wave this issue away, right? They're like, clearly GPT-4 is intelligent, therefore, you know, GPT-6 will be more intelligent and therefore we should be scared. And you're like, GPT-4 is intelligent is already a statement that kind of assumes too much about what intelligence is and like asks us to kind of query it. Because like, if your question of intelligence is it like, can it write a sonnet and can it give me instructions to write code? Then yeah, it is intelligent. But at the same time, it has difficulty with palindromes and playing tic-tac-toe and like, maybe it's not, I don't know. Like, I mean, we are kind of trying to define intelligence to fit into a bucket so that we can use that same concept in talking about humans and then talking about sort of this system. And I don't think it transfers very neatly at all because there is a set of capabilities that overlap, but there's also a whole list of inner features that don't overlap. I mean, you know, autoregressive models function in a particular fashion that is not similar to how humans function. But like I said, sort of, I wrote sort of a post recently where like I was trying to envision how, you know, what Holden Konofsky calls PASTA will actually come about. And I think it is feasible. I think it is possible that a system where we kind of give it an objective, it is able to use the tools that it has and kind of reasoning that it does in order to get to a point where it can solve some sort of scientific problems on its own. Is it likely to be conceptual leaps like the shape of benzene or, you know, general theory of relativity? I don't know. I doubt it, but I have no idea. Is it likely to be some of the more like, you know, what Kuhn might call like within paradigm leaps? Possibly. But that will already kind of provide us a tremendous speed up in terms of how we think about our scientific progress.
All right, that's fair. I was just skimming through the post before you were speaking through it. It takes a while, but yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, that one was longer than I anticipated.
Have you, so, you know, what do you think of, speaking of, you know, actions we can do today, what do you think of the proposals to have compulsory evals? I'll share my sort of proposal, which is that, you know how electrical products have the CE sticker, which is the way it works is you have to self-certify that this thing is good, it's a safe, and randomly they pick some percent of those and they test it, and if it doesn't work, so you're forced to recall the product. I suppose that's a great analogy for how you might want to have, you know, how you might want to have regulations in the current world, which is that if you're genuinely worried about LLMs having whatever risks, allow developers to self-certify, have a government testing agency which you know is allowed to run evals on these, and if you find, you know, whatever criterion is predefined for recall or shutdown, that's the time when the government is legally allowed to force these things down. What do you think of that?
I don't have a huge amount of thought around it beyond the fact that regulations in general tend to be heavy-handed. Standard-based regulations have rarely worked in software, except for specific instances of deployment. And I don't see why it should be different here. Like, we don't ask, I don't know, operating systems to have that stamp. We don't ask social media to have that stamp. We don't ask Google search to have that stamp. So at some point, there's a list of things that we would like the tool to not be able to do that we kind of ask it to kind of give it safe, reliable responses.
I mean,
with LLMs.
You're right.
Like the idea of evals. Mm-hmm. I do like the idea of evals because, like, evals make us trust it more rather than putting all the onus on the user to test and figure out what it can and cannot do. So like in many ways, it is important for the makers of these tools to actually do enough evaluations that it actually becomes useful. However, do you want to enforce it through regulation? I don't see a huge amount of advantage, but I'm relatively agnostic about it. If you say like it needs X amount of red teaming or something, like maybe, but like I don't see how that is not just pushing the development of these tools primarily to the largest companies who have the resources to kind of put against it, as opposed to like the smaller companies.
Yeah, no,
that's my
I'm saying knee-jerk that,
reaction,
If sorry, I mean one part is just that we do have a lot of in sort of, you know, critical domains. You do have a lot of regulation about software, right? You have health privacy stuff in the healthcare sector. Banks routinely spend years trying to test the system. So, yeah, I mean, it's true that for consumer products you have little regulation. Although I think the EU is going to change that at some point of time. But at some point you're going to have these social media bias. Although I'm not sure how it's going to work, but they're going to try something of that. But you know, there's this. So do I correctly understand that you know, at least for the near future, these should be regulated no more differently than we do with existing social media, I mean existing consumer tech applications?
I mean, today, if you want to deploy an LLM into sort of a banking system, I'm sure you'll have to go through the same compliance regulatory regime, or like show that it's ISO certified, whatever it might be. You would need to show something equivalent before it gets deployed in specific places. Does it need more than that? I'm not sure. Does it need more in order for something to be developed and deployed and given to sort of most people like you or I? I definitely don't think so. If nothing else, like such a large part of the excitement around it is because you have large open source models that you or I can download and play with and actually create stuff on top of that we can run on our own devices. That gets kneecapped if you say, like, you know, without a particular certification, Rohit bot cannot talk to Pradyu bot. That is bad for both of us, right? Because we are both opting into that system. So like, to me, it doesn't make a huge amount of sense for us to be able to regulate sort of the tool. We should totally regulate the usage. We do that today. Like, you know, try deploying a piece of software into a bank, an insurance company, a telco, a hospital, a nuclear reactor, you know, cybersecurity that you want to deploy anywhere in the government. The amount of hoop jumping you have to do is insane because like they correctly understand that these things are incredibly complicated and therefore you need extensive testing before it becomes sensible for you to be able to use it. So it's a little bit of a, like, there's no one swath that actually answers it. My broader question is like, any regulation that you put, if it's like, people use regulation today in like a few different ways, right? There's a bunch of people who are pushing for regulation because they genuinely believe it is necessary for us to be able to use software. So these are, you know, there's including tech journalists. They're like, you know, oh, look at what that lawyer did. He should not have done that. This is on ChatGPT. There's a bunch of those people. I am not one of those people. I feel like if a lawyer is dumb enough to use citations that he hasn't checked, that's on the lawyer, not on like whatever tool he ended up using. There's a second group who think of regulation as a way to just pause or slow down AI development. Like they're like, we want as much regulation as possible. It should be heavily regulated, like nuclear reactors or whatever absurd kind of parallel they want to draw to biotech. And they say like, no. Stop, regulate them heavily. It should be as hard for people to create a model as it is for a new drug to kind of pass through FDA or something, which is kind of, you know, it's a ridiculous standard, but is primarily aimed at slowing things down. And like, as you know, most of the drugs are, there are 10 large drug companies in the world. And there's a reason they have an oligopolistic kind of stance where they spend more on marketing rather than on R&D, right? I mean, it doesn't happen by accident. It's because of, it's one of the outcomes of the regulatory regime that we think is important. And the third group that says like, hey, yes, like not opposed to regulation per se, but you regulate the things that should be regulated, like where it's used, how it's used, etc., as opposed to regulating the thing in itself, so that the broader group of sort of any so that the regulation doesn't stop people from actually creating interesting things. I fall into kind of that camp where I don't care whether it's LLMs or various versions of reinforcement learning or like AlphaGo tuned to the X, you want to deploy into a system where we think outcomes matter, then yeah, you need to kind of get it certified and whatever, right? I mean, like, again, the company that sort of I was on the board of, Deep Instinct, it does deep learning for cybersecurity. They had to go through a whole host of like testing and learning and like getting all sorts of certifications before they were allowed to kind of deploy into a whole sort of different places. And it was painful because like, it's not easy to understand, you know, like how it works. So you have to kind of have fairly extensive testing before you're able to give it any kind of like, whatever, stamp of approval. To me, like that works, you know? If you want to, if you or Rohit want to create an LLM that we want to kind of deploy into missile guidance systems, then yeah, there bloody well should be some way to actually test it to make sure that it works.
All right. Thank you for your time. I think we've overdone our time by a little bit, but it was fun talking anyways. If people want to read more and find you online, where can they find you?
Twitter @KrishnanRohit or strangeloopcanon.com.